Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. We have September 27, 2012, and a lot of interesting little topics tonight. The main science topic, I'm going to be talking somewhat about philosophy of developing science, and somewhat about simplicity. In simplicity, there's many very complex issues in science, but the concept of simplicity, but I'll be giving examples of that. First of all, I'm just going to give a solar report here. The 21st of September, which is the first day of autumn, we had a series of 10 CMEs. So these are coronal mass ejections coming off the sun in rapid succession. This was very interesting to see, and just shows you that the sun is unpredictable. It can be very quiet. It has been extremely quiet, and then all of a sudden, just boom, 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 like that. The conditions right now, we are, interestingly enough, back in a zero dynamic pressure state, which means it looks like we've fallen back into what I call the August return current sheet. And that can happen because these plasma sheets are like a snake out there in outer space. They're kind of swooping back and forth. We've had some turbulent activity in the solar wind recently, and that's what's driving the severe weather around the world. A lot of the areas of the United States, we have a very big high pressure cell, so most of the United States has been clear and dry and beautiful fall weather. But not so in other parts of the world. Antarctica is experiencing some pretty harsh weather. There's a major typhoon moving into the area of Thailand, Vietnam, and it looks like it'll brush by there and continue on into the Indian Ocean. It's hard to say. That's tracking rather far south to twist back up and go up by Japan. But that's occurring right now. Not much noted in the Western press, I might add. But something very strange has been happening over the past weeks, and I've kind of been watching this and just thought it would go away, kind of like a bad cold, and you just thought it would go away. But there's a tropical storm turned hurricane and then back to a tropical storm at the present time called Nadine. Now, this storm has been wandering around the North Atlantic for weeks. It's really kind of strange. And so it looks like somebody is playing with their laser satellites. Maybe they're giving some practice to some new members of the weather control. Maybe it's being used for training purposes, let's put it that way. But extremely rare behavior. Let me give you a history of Nadine. It came in, developed in the mid-Atlantic, which is typical of storms this time of year. They run northwards, and they can run up to England, causing a little bit of weather problems up there, or up to as far north as the Scandinavian Peninsula. But this storm turned east and headed towards the Canary Islands, where it kind of went north, then east, then south, then west, and then kind of in circles. And at this time, it's tracking a little bit west. But it's been there for weeks, just kind of wandering around the North Atlantic. So just something, if you have a world weather map and you go there, just look at this storm. It's kind of a nothing storm right now. But just very interesting that a storm, a tropical storm, which should dissipate in a number of days, has been wandering around the North Atlantic for weeks. I want to make a comment here. Spaceweather.com has been reporting for a long time about auroras. They have a aurora watch. And here again, I can't figure out what they're really trying to do, but and it really doesn't warrant any recognition in the news. But for a long time, they've been reporting auroras. But these auroras are near the North Pole, the Arctic Circle, where there are always auroras, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And so they're reporting these auroras like, oh, look at the auroras. It's really something. People are reporting big auroras. And then they quote people saying like, oh, this was a big aurora. Well, let me tell you something. If you live at the Arctic Circle, you're going to see auroras every day. So my question is, what is spaceweather.com doing? Why are they reporting these auroras? And as the reality is, I mentioned this on last week's show, that we have had a very slow aurora many, many years, literally without auroras. I'm a person that tracks and goes. I like to see auroras just because they're almost like artwork. They're fun to watch, and each one is different. Each one reacts differently. But once again, what is spaceweather.com doing? Why are they stressing these auroras when it's something that happens every day, it's no big deal, and they're trying to promote auroras like they're really something, when in fact the very opposite is true? We have not had hardly any auroras for years. So I don't know what they're doing. I don't want to pose any solutions or possible motives for this behavior, this strange behavior, but at any rate, it's just reporting it. I just want to talk about permissions. When I was at Cornell, for example, it was back in the late 70s, early 1980s, Cornell University, and the space probe data was coming in. I was working on my theoretical work, work that I had been working on for years, and it was solidifying as I was there watching data come in from outer space, publishing papers. I didn't ask permission to do anything that I did. And from the obvious result, they called me in on a number of occasions telling me that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And it's like, no, I'm not asking permission. And so I was in a place where I knew what I was doing. I was doing far, decades ahead of my time in what I was doing. And no, I wasn't going to ask permission from anybody or accept the concept that I should ask permission to use data. Later, NASA developed a policy primarily because of what I was doing. I was taking NASA data that came in off the spacecraft. I had access to it in the raw form as it came in, something that was readily available back then. But very shortly afterwards, they started putting the lid on data. Only the principal investigators could see the data. And then after they had homogenized it and blended it into their own fashion, only the end result data that they would release with their published articles, only that data was available. The raw data was hidden in an archive within NASA. So for years, I tried to get data from certain space probes, etc., only to find out that, no, that is with the principal investigators, and after 6 months, then it can be released. And then after the 6 months to the day, I would call them up and I'd say, okay, now I want the data. Oh, well, we've changed the rule to 12 months. And then after 12 months, of course, I was right there. It's now, well, the data is still with the principal investigators. They still don't quite want to release it yet. And this dog and pony, this little show went on, and finally, about the mid-90s, finally a guy named Dan Golden came into NASA and put the security lid on that. His job was to put the cap on NASA. And that's when all of the NASA scientists that remained, a lot of them they got rid of, but the ones that remained had to sign non-disclosure agreements, gag orders basically, and they are subject to release policies of NASA. So that's why last week I told the story about the woman, what was her name, Maria Zuber. She was talking about the data results of the moon density, our moon. The NASA had two satellites orbiting the moon. And she needed permission to talk about the data. And since the data wasn't publicly released yet, she was not at liberty to say anything, not even one word, because immediately someone like myself could jump on it. And a lot of times these scientists are very inexperienced in the real way the world spins, so that they come out shooting their mouth off. I was in on a news conference one time with a guy named Michael Brown. He was an astronomer. He's on the new planetary discovery team, the automated search routines with telescopes searching for planetary objects, and they had discovered the planet Sedna. At the time, it was called a new planet. Since Pluto has been demoted as a planet, and so has Sedna and about 40 other Sedna-like objects that are out there, now called Kuiper Belt objects, as if they were some kind of little asteroid or something, but they're full-blown planets. But they had to demote them because all of a sudden they'd have to announce that the solar system has 40 new planets, and that would raise all kinds of uncomfortable questions from the public. So they just decided to, behind closed doors, a secret little group of astronomers voted to demote Pluto and all the other Kuiper Belt objects from being planets, and started calling them something else, Kuiper Belt objects, trying to minimize the effect that 40 new planets had been discovered. Those are the ones they publicly announced, and I'm sure they've discovered many more that are all have the caps on them, so that the public isn't finding out. But the point is that all of these scientists need to have permission. These scientists have sold out to their soul and their careers and their lives and their education and their hopes in the future to a government paycheck, basically. And I don't bow to that. I don't cater to that. And that's too bad that all of these scientists have gone that way. And this filters down into private corporations also. It's not just the agencies. I tell a little story. I was at a American Geophysical Union International Conference one time, and the people were setting up a booth next to me. This had the topic was dealing with the new data on X-rays from comets. And this woman had gotten her PhD, and she was with the group from Goddard. On my name badge, it said James McCanny, independent scientist. And, of course, everybody else has affiliation, NASA Goddard or Harvard or, you know, Caltech or some, you know, Gulf South Research or some affiliation. And so mine said independent scientist. And, she kind of was curiously looking at this for a while. Finally, she couldn't contain herself any longer, and she said, what's an independent scientist? What affiliation? What does that mean? And I said, well, that means I support my own research. I do my own work. I am my own person, and I don't get government funding. I don't ask for, I don't receive, I don't want government funding. And she looked at me like I was completely out of my mind, and she said, how can you operate as a scientist without government funding? This was totally remote to this woman. It was like this was something that had to be from at least another parallel universe, if not more. So the point I'm going back to is permission. I don't ask permission to do this show, to talk. I don't ask permission to talk about the topics I talk about. And I don't have sponsors, because as soon as you have a sponsor, they all want to come in and influence what you talk about on your show. So I don't have sponsors. I just I pay for my own airtime. This show comes to you commercial free. But at any rate, the call comes back to permission. I don't ask permission from nobody, nowhere, not gonna, never have, not gonna in the future. And I've seen many, 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 many talk show hosts over the years fall into a trap, and it's a trap that's set for them. Somebody comes along and says, I'm going to make you a star. You are really good at your radio show, and we're going to make you big, big, big. But we got to get all these sponsors, and we're going to get shows. We're going to put you on a lot more shortwave. We're going to put you on AM. You're going to be on FM. We're going to get you a PR person that can promote you, and you're going to be big. We're going to have a staff. You know, this is going to be, you're going to be set up with better money. Just think of all the possibilities. And these people are thinking dollars. You know, running a little talk show is not exactly what you'd call a lucrative business. And so at any rate, these people would fall into these traps. And you would see them, oh boy, they would grow, and all of a sudden they had a little staff, they had a secretary. And then one day, in come the sponsors. And they go, geez, you know, we can't support your show anymore because you talked about this on your show. Oh, well, they had two choices. They could stop talking about that, those topics, or you could, you have two choices. You either go with what they say, or you lose your sponsors. So now you've gone from a medium, moderate-sized show up to expanding. Now all of a sudden, somebody's telling you what you can say and what you can't say. And so that's when your show ends, because you've got bills. You got to pay the bills that go along with the airtime and everything else. So as a result, these people, they have two choices, and I've seen them go two ways. I've seen them fold and just go under and disappear, and then some of them try to struggle back, and they just can't, so they just go away. Or they bite and they say, okay, I will just talk about that. I'll modify just this little bit. And then next week, it's another little bit. Then the next week, it's another little bit. Then next week, somebody's controlling their web page. And all of a sudden, they're completely owned. And they try and pretend and put on an air of being independent, but they're really not. Behind the scenes, someone's pulling the strings. So I just want to talk about that. So that's permission. They're bending to finances. They want to remain a star. They want to remain big. And they think they're really hot stuff, but they're controlled. They have to ask permission. They have to get permission. And so, as I said, I already know all the games on the planet. I've had people, all kinds of tricks, and I won't go through the laundry list of all the tricks that the CIA and everybody else are trying to throw at me to try and divert me from what I'm doing. They have people that are paid to follow me around the internet to try and badmouth me, to try and twist what I'm saying, to try and be my greatest fan and then take it, what I'm saying, and twist it. Oh, it just doesn't end. So, but anyway, just to reiterate something, I only post on my webpage, I only post on my radio show, and my information comes out in my own books, which are only available on my webpage. And so the point is, I basically filter everything that goes out from me. But you might find pages with my name on it, but that's not me. I don't have anything to do with these, and these are government-controlled, basically spy pages that are trying to destroy my name. So if you've, I know people will set up email lists, and this is Jim McCanny says this. I don't have email lists, and there's a very good reason, because they become infiltrated. So if you've gotten emails about me or whatever, they're not from me. I don't work with anybody. I work by myself. I always have. I always will. And the few times I've tried to work with a couple people, it just doesn't work out. It's just my information is very complicated. It's very detailed. And, you know, it's just something I do myself. It's something I'll continue doing myself. So at any rate, and this is kind of for kids, so I want to give people an idea. I've been working at what I've been doing for many decades, and a lot of people, a lot of the newbie wannabes are jumping around the internet trying to be experts in Electric Universe or Planet X or 2012. You find that these people really don't have any track record. A lot of them try and talk about, oh, they've been around for 20 or 30 years. They all say 30 years. But when you look, there's nothing there. There's like they must have been sitting in grandma's basement for 20, 30 years and all of a sudden decided they wanted to be famous and get an internet site and then go around, copy everybody else's work and pretend it's their own. That's the typical scenario. They don't have any history. They don't have anything to show, anything real to show. At any rate, but the reason I wanted to bring this back, I want to talk to kids. I don't care if it's music or art or all the things they don't teach you in school today, the things that you want to pursue in your life, you don't have to ask permission. A lot of people live their lives with a negative thought, well, I can't do that because of this or that, or I don't have enough money, or I can't do this. I like the story of a guy named Jimmy Jam. He grew up as a poor black kid in Minneapolis. And they went out and somehow got together some old tape decks, some old broken down tape decks, and they put them together and they started recording music and started putting it out, started getting it on the radio, pretty soon finding kids in the neighborhood, and these kids turned out to be stars. And went on to be one of the richest people in Hollywood. So don't let people tell you you can't do something. Don't let people tell you you need permission. You go out and you do it. I'm not talking about robbing banks. I'm talking about developing personally. You don't need permission to develop personally. So at any rate, I'm kind of pounding on that, but I want kids out there to understand that through your life, your school, your all kinds of authorities are going to tell you you can't do things. If you want to develop your talents, you go do it. You find a way to do it, and that's the way it is. So you don't need permission. On to the next topic. Just a quick comment, and this is nothing new, the fact that the lives of billions of people around the world are being destroyed by the banking systems. And these are the systems that control the governments, that control the wars of the world, that keep the conflicts going in the world. And the utter destruction of people's lives, just wholesale destruction worldwide for the greed of a few. I'm going to make a quick comment here. A comet is coming into the sun in November of 2013. It's called Comet C2012-S1, ISON. Let's see, it's right now beyond the orbit of Jupiter, but it's going to come very, very close, within 2 million kilometers of the solar surface. So the apologists for the comet community, the standard comet community, are already out there, oh, the little icy wanderer, and talking about the possibilities of what it could happen. The ultimate fate remains unknown. At this stage, we're throwing darts at the board. This is Carl Batham's NASA-supported Sungrazer Comet project, and he lays out two possibilities. Oh, gee, he's an expert in the dirty snowball comet model. It could be extremely bright, or it might not turn out to be anything at all. Gee, that's quite a prediction, Carl. But at any rate, the silliness, the standard science silliness regarding this comet is already beginning, but they want to head it off at the pass because this thing could come in and start reacting with the sun and do all kinds of things that they really don't want people to see or know about. But at any rate, it's something I'll be keeping an eye on. Comet C20, let me go back to the designation again. C 2012 S1, and then ISON is the commonly called ISON. But at any rate, that's something I'll be keeping track of clearly over as this develops, as this comet develops. And also, if it has any, I'll be giving more information on its orbit, possibilities of viewing sunward spikes on this comet. There will be a lot of analysis on this comet as the next year and a month, about 13 months, pass. So at any rate, just letting you know about that. Keep an eye on that. I'll be giving you updates very frequently on that comet. This came out recently, and I think it's extremely interesting and timely. An email came in from a listener, and it said, there's a European study that shows that Monsanto GMO corn causes cancer in rats. And so there's a study that shows for the first time that 70% of female rats that were fed a diet of Monsanto corn, I'll just read this so I get a better quote, says, after only 4 months of exposure, 50% of male rats and 70% of female rats fed a diet of containing Monsanto's NK603 GMO corn or exposed to Monsanto's Roundup weed killer developed tumors and multiple organs, which eventually led to their premature deaths. And so I can imagine if somebody's eating Roundup, it's probably not the best thing for you. All other studies, it says, cited by Monsanto as to the safety of their GMO products were only conducted over a 3-month period of time and, of course, were subject to Monsanto testing. No longer-term studies had ever been performed. So at any rate, many parts of Europe, South America, and other parts of the world have banned GMO corn or GMO products in general. So it's something I'm going to keep track of that. But this leads into an interesting topic. This past week, I posted on the webpage a corn sale, and so the fall harvest is in. And of course, this year the U.S. corn crop is terrible. It's at about 20%, which, I mean, this is famine. We're talking ancient Egyptian levels of famine here. The price of food is going to skyrocket. It's really going to be something in the months coming up, months and years ahead, because you have 20% of the corn crop, and that goes into all kinds of things, not the least of which is biofuels. So now people are going to be competing for grain, but this drives up the world prices on food and grains. All of the other grains then will rise in price. But I have one last time. In fact, 2008, I started the corn seed sale, and that went on 2008. And then two times since then, I've sold corn on a limited scale. This was corn seed, non-GMO, non-hybrid, non-GMO, dense corn seed, the kind of corn seed you would have found on the family farm. But when I sold it, it was like $110 for 5,000 seeds. And so that's not a bad price. That's just a couple cents a seed. And people grew this with great success. Other people had marginal, other people had poor success. Depending, it looked like it depended on growing season, other kinds of factors. I had some people who are used to growing GMO corn who don't understand how to grow non-GMO corn using the standard techniques of agriculture, not using organic techniques of agriculture, and getting rather poor results. So there was a mixture. The seed was not allowed to go into Australia. There were other countries that blocked the seed from entering through customs. But the seed went far and wide, and I have gotten results back from far and wide, where people are growing this with tremendous, tremendous success. And I understand that I'm viewed as somewhat of a folk hero in certain circles because of the fact that these people now have independence. They're growing their corn organically. It's the original Dent corn seed. And thanks to this effort, this original corn seed, natural corn seed, is succeeding around the world. And as Monsanto and Cargill and the other seed companies, as their corn fails miserably, they will go away. After a year of bad harvest, they will simply go away. But at any rate, now what I've done, after the fall harvest here, I'm having one last sale, and this is going to be the last time I do any sales of corn seed. There won't be any next spring. We're going to sell off everything we've got right now, and that's going to be it. We're not going to pursue this any longer. So this is the last chance, and also I've reduced the price, the cost, and greatly increased the amount of seed. So for 10 pounds of seed, by the way, the 5,000 seeds for $110, you got about 3.5 pounds of seed. Now the sale is 10 pounds of seed for $40. So you can see that the cost has gone way down, and we estimate there will be about 20,000 seeds in that, enough to plant about an acre of corn. And so plus $11 shipping, $51. This is in the USA only. We're only shipping to the USA. It can go to the 50 states. But that's going on right now. So without going into a lot further detail, go to the webpage jmccsci.com, and you can get this corn seed. It's $50 for the 10 pounds of corn seed in any place in the 50 states, or you can get it free with any $300 purchase, and then quite a few people are taking advantage of that. So they can buy the new calendar, they can buy the water filter products or books or whatever, and if the order adds up to more than $300, they get the corn seed for free. Also, that it's still in effect that if you buy more than $200 of any items, you would get the calendar free too, the recalendar SunStar clock. So if you bought more than $300 worth of things, you would get both the free corn and the free calendar. So that's a number of people are taking advantage of that. And like I say, this is the last time I will sell any corn like this. It's just, I have my own personal reasons, but it's gotten out there. It's been a great success, and I know this corn is off and running, and people are giving seed away, and it's spreading. And while Monsanto and Cargill are failing, which I predicted they would, they had to fail. It's like, let's take, for example, a number of weeks ago I announced that there was a bacteria or a virus. Form of staph infection that people are getting in the hospital called C. diff, and diff for difficult. And they have given that it's something that grew in the hospitals. It's infecting people that go to hospitals and clinics, and people are dying from this because what happened? People went to a clinic with staph or other types of infections, took partial regimens of their antibiotics, and slowly, you know, 20, 30 years ago, tetracycline was the major antibiotic used for infections. All of a sudden, the infections became resistant. They grew to learn to actually eat tetracycline for lunch. And so the antibiotics had to change, get stronger and stronger. Now they're at the point where they can't find anything to combat these. I don't even want to go near a hospital or an operating room or a clinic. I don't even want to touch the doorknob. So at any rate, and this is interesting, a lot of people are like that today too. When little Obama is requiring people to buy health insurance or get fined. So at any rate, pretty weird stuff going on out there. But the point is that Monsanto did the same thing with corn. They had it Roundup ready, and the Roundup would kill everything, but now Roundup can no longer kill the weeds. And also the Roundup Ready corn, we had drought conditions. What can you say? If it doesn't rain, I don't care what kind of corn you have, what kind of herbicides or insecticides or Roundup or whatever, it isn't going to grow. So I understand most of Illinois has plowed under its corn crop. Wasn't enough there to even bother starting up the machines to harvest. Many of the other states the same way. The overall corn harvest at 20%. And so what I'm saying is that this corn seed is something that will take the world into the future. Okay, so enough of that. But if you can, go to the webpage. And if nothing else, buy it and give it away to somebody who you know likes gardening or has a farm. Once again, 10 pounds of the non-GMO Dent corn seed. And this will be the last time I ever offer this for $40 plus $10 shipping. That's $50, and it's to any place in the 50 states, or buy more than $300 worth of items, and you get the corn free plus the free calendar. Just a calendar update. This is an interesting thing. Last 3 weeks I talked about calendars, the history of calendars, etc. And here's an interesting thing that I said that Julius Caesar invoked the Julian calendar, the one we still use today. But back prior to that, there were only 10 months. If you go back to Babylon, they had a 12-month year, 12 segments, the 12 zones of the zodiac. But in old Rome, they had actually 10 months of the year. And so the month of July is named after Julius Caesar. Of course, if you were emperor of Rome, you would have your own month in honor of you. And August is in honor of Augusta Caesar. Both got their own months. So July and August were added as months, and you'll note that they both have 31 days, which is befitting of a Roman emperor, right? So, just wanted to point out that September, October, November, and December, the names are literally the number of the month. But September, for Septimo, would be 7. And really, September is the 9th month. Well, it's the 9th month because Julius and Augustus Caesar both got their own months, July and August. And so September retained its name of September, the 7th month, but it's now the 9th month. October would represent octo, or 8, but it's the 10th month of the year. November for noveno, and the 9th month of the year, but really it's the 11th month of the year. And December for decimo, and would be the 10th month of the year, but now it's the 12th month. All because Julius and Augustus Caesar got their month. So that's just a little calendar fun fact of the week. So I'll be talking more about where the names of months come from, every now and then throwing in a little kind of fun fact about calendars. Let's see. I wanted to talk about world weather here just a little bit. So I'm going to pull up my map that I'm looking at. And we have today a little hurricane running off the Aleutian Islands off of Alaska. It's a full-blown hurricane. And a beautiful shape, everything like that. Also, we have a major storm, as I said earlier, moving into the region of South China, the South China Sea, where Atlantis used to be, by the way, moving into the Thailand-Vietnamese Peninsula, so just moving directly west, and a lot of kind of choppy, severe weather around the world at this point. Europe and Northern Europe, all the way up into Scandinavia, experiencing some heavy weather. We've got little tropical storm Nadine meandering around the North Atlantic. Got some tropical storm activity off the southwest corner of Mexico. And we have the southern region of Panama getting some fairly heavy weather. But the South China Sea, the Southwest Pacific, and all the way into the Indian Ocean getting some fairly severe microstorms, small heavy-duty storm activity. But this worldwide weather, and as I said, the United States has been, except for one little kind of storm system in the panhandle of Texas, the United States has pretty nice weather, and it's going to have for some time to come. We'll get little waves of clouds and maybe a scatter of rain, but I doubt it, for the majority of the United States. But on a worldwide scale, the fairly severe high-energy storm systems occurring around the world. So better there than here, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. I want to talk a little bit about simplifying your life. And so this is something that we all have to do occasionally. Go through... Just look around. I mean, look through the kitchen, look through the your clothes, and simplify. Just look for those things that you don't use, you haven't used. The rule is that if you haven't used it in 6 months, you're not going to use it. So sometimes we become very attached. And sometimes I kid people that I say, all I want to do is just live in a tent, and I want one pot to cook in. That's it. That's all I want. I don't want any complexity in my life. But, of course, in this modern day and age, that is impossible. But let's look at the reason for this. A lot of these diversions are placed on us. They are placed in our path. And, of course, people want to sell things. Everybody wants you to buy their latest and greatest iPhone or TV or high definition, a better high definition of Blu-ray, whatever it is, three-dimensional Blu-ray. I mean, how far can you go to watch entertainment? And how much time are you going to spend doing this? But at any rate, simplify, simplify, simplify your life. Get rid of stuff, take away the complexities, try and simplify your financial life, down to the point where it's, you know, it's just things are very simple. And but the point here, the reason I'm talking about this, because it's something we should all do, spring cleaning, now we're in fall, it'd be a good thing to do before fall hits. But there's such a thing as simplification in science. And right now, science in general is in a dilemma. They have a quagmire of complex concepts, and it's like I liken it to the old days of Copernicus and Galileo. Copernicus made a comment one time, and of course that progression of Kepler, Copernicus, and Newton, and then on into the modern analysis of both science, astronomy, space science, etc. There is a very great necessity to simplify. But what's going on today, the science world cannot simplify, it cannot change. It's locked into this mode of comets are dirty snowballs, that the Big Bang happened 4.5 billion years ago. Let's look at the fact that they talk the concept that They talk about there cannot be electricity in the universe or in the solar system, and that comets are dirty snowballs. These concepts are locked in place. In my original writings, I called them the axioms of astronomy. There was a editor of a journal. He was in England. He was a very high up in the astronomical community until he started making sure my articles got published. His name was Zenak Kopal. He resided in England, but he had control over many space science astronomy journals back in the late 1970s when I started publishing. And as a result of my publishing my papers and showing that comets were not dirty snowballs, he made a comment in a letter back to me. That's when letters, nobody had email, there was no email, there were no bulletin boards, there was no computer to write anybody. Everything was done in letters. And so my papers were going in, they were being published, and that's when I was in, a lot of it was written when I was in the physics department at Cornell, but after they decided that I was not welcome there, and I went across campus and I got rehired by the math department at Cornell University, my papers were being published under my name, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University. And so Zenak Kopal was writing to me at the Department of Mathematics, and he said, "It's unfortunate, but astronomy has become like a religion with axioms rather than scientific discovery." And so what he was pointing to was the fact that the dirty snowball comet model at the time, called the iceball comet model, IBCM, and which I called it the iceball comet model, it has since migrated to be called the Whipple dirty snowball comet model. And the idea, though, is that science locked into these axioms a long, long time ago. And here's how it actually happened. In the 1950s, Velikovsky was printing his books and publishing and selling all over the world, translated into 14 languages. Velikovsky was saying that there's something wrong with astronomy, that the astronomy theories didn't add up according to the ancients. The ancients all around the world were talking about this comet Venus that came through the solar system, and eventually this big comet became the planet Venus. And so it was selling, and there was just outrage coming out of the astronomical community. And so the people like the New York Times, science section, etc., went, because Velikovsky was living in New York. He was at Columbia University. And so all of this was happening in New York. Macmillan, the book publisher, of course, was from New York. And then Doubleday, who later took over the Velikovsky books when Macmillan threw them out the window, Doubleday took over the books, and a guy I met, Hugh O'Neill, was the editor of from Doubleday, and that was the only job Hugh O'Neill had his whole life. His whole career for Doubleday was simply managing the Velikovsky books, and just because they were the biggest selling book in the world. So at any rate, going back to the 1950s, when the Velikovsky books first started coming out and were published by Macmillan, who was primarily a textbook company, they went and they asked the standard scientific community. They said, "Well, you're up in arms. You're saying that Venus could not have been a comet, that comets can't become planets, that none of this fits into your framework of science." They said, "Well, what do you think? What is your theory? Tell us, and then we'll print it in the paper." Well, they didn't have any. They didn't have an answer. They didn't think Velikovsky could be right, but they didn't have an answer to tell. So they had to quick muster the forces, get them together, and that's when a guy named Whipple was at Harvard University. And so he put together a kind of solidified the concept that no, comets had to be dirty snowballs, or ice balls is what they called them at the time. And that concept goes all the way back to Kepler. Kepler was the first guy to take measurements, detailed measurements of comet positions in the sky. Prior to that, comets were thought to be fire in the atmosphere, an Aristotelian thought that had been taught for literally thousands of years since the ancient Greeks. Since the ancient Greeks had looked up and seen comets and said, well, look, it must be something burning in the atmosphere. That was the Aristotelian concept of a comet. So along comes Kepler. He's developing orbits. He's verifying Copernican dynamics of the solar system with the sun in the center. He's able to calculate and describe the orbits of the planets. And using the inverse cube rule of ellipses, he's able to look at comets and determine that, no, they're not in the atmosphere. They're way out there. They're orbiting the sun just like the planets, but they're in elliptical orbits. So Kepler said, well, gee, what could they be? They must be something like ice balls, and when they get near the sun, they melt, and then the light of the sun or whatever pushes the tail away. So that's where that ice ball comet concept came from. It came from Kepler. So anyway, in the 1950s, Whipple picked it up and was made very famous because he was a relatively young person at Harvard University at the time in the astronomy department. So many of his students jumped on board and they all were studying these ice ball comets. The only trouble is that when we finally went out to see a comet, none of them were dirty snowballs or ice balls. They didn't have any ice or snow on them at all. And they certainly didn't have ice or water turning into steam coming off the nucleus that would fuel that big tail constantly for months and months and months as they moved through the solar system. So, but anyway, that didn't matter in 1950 because all you needed was a degree from Harvard or a degreed position at Harvard, and you could say whatever you wanted, and that had to be taken as the gospel truth. So that's where these concepts started. And once they became in vogue, no, you can't change that. But let's look at something else. The Velikovsky was real specific. I always find it ironic that Velikovsky was Jewish. I mean, there's no question he was Jewish. He had lived in Israel. He came from Russia. He was definitely a Russian Jew before many of them had moved into Germany and to Europe. And in the to form the businesses in Berlin and that Velikovsky was from Russia, and he eventually moved to Berlin, and he knew Einstein, who was also Jewish, and they moved to the U.S. about the same time, and of course this is all related to all the activity in World War II. And so they remained good friends. The guy I interviewed, he's on many of my shows and on my CDs. Warner Sizemore was basically Velikovsky's right-hand man, drove him around because Velikovsky himself didn't drive, was there with him every day until he died. But the point is that Velikovsky worked alone. He was another guy that worked alone. There's a lot of wannabes running around the internet claiming to be Velikovsky supporters, but the reality is that Velikovsky worked alone. And his historical studies of Venus the comet becoming Venus the planet were very revolutionary. What my work did is when I got to Cornell, and by the way, I didn't even know about Velikovsky when I was at Cornell. I had been out of the country for quite a while, the better part of maybe 10 years, and so I had not, I was not familiar with Velikovsky. I developed all of my electric universe concepts and the comet, the plasma discharge comet model and the induced electric dipole redshift. All of that work I developed on my own while I was at Cornell, And it was only later, a number of years later, that somebody pointed out that, hey, your work kind of looks like this Velikovsky guy's the same story. And that's when I started putting together my own archaeology work with that of Velikovsky and realizing that he was way, way ahead of his time and that the standard science community was completely wrong. But going back to this concept of simplification, the idea that science has to simplify, and since the time of Velikovsky, of course, eventually we had space probes. They went to Venus, they went to Mercury, they went to all the different outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. We've got one on the way to Pluto right now. But inevitably, as the data came in, it had to be interpreted into and molded into square pegs going into round holes and round pegs going into square holes. It had to be molded into those axioms of astronomy. And later it became even more forceful. But the point about Velikovsky being Jewish is that in his books he's very emphatic about the fact that he was writing about the Moses event, that the people with Moses were Israelites. And here's coming from a guy who lived in Russia, was a Russian Jew, moved to Germany, and eventually moved out of Germany, like I say, with all the activity of World War II, but very much knew the history of the Israelites, the true followers of Moses, and which distinguishes from the Jewish history. So I think it's important to note those events in Velikovsky's work. It's very clear that he talks about the Israelites, and that could be possibly one of the things that alienated him from some of the communities, especially the publishing community of New York and other communities. But then also there was a big effort to ban his work worldwide, and the more they tried to ban it, the more successful he became. And like I say, today there's a bunch of wannabe people running around trying to copy part of his work and then extend it to other things. And, of course, that's the unfortunate thing because Velikovsky is dead. He's not here to defend himself. But the whole idea of simplification of science, it's where science has to go, but it refuses to do it because they are locked into this modern era of the axioms of astronomy. Remember to go to the webpage jmccsci.com and get your corn. It's the last time this corn will be available ever. And it's a great price, 10 pounds for $40 plus $10 shipping. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.